KALW.
There are a lot of victims of crime out here in the city who deserve to have a district attorney's office that puts the politics in the trash can.
Today, the history of the San Francisco DA's office, from a cannabis activist to the future vice president to a former beat cop to the present day.
George was the battering ram, and Chesa is like the bulldozer, just like taking it to the next level.
We're continuing our series, The Progressive Prosecutor. Then we ask singer and guitarist Tom Heyman to spill the dirt on those wild stories in his bluesy songs.
Are they true? I'll never tell. They might be. Mostly, maybe.
That's coming up. I'm Hannah Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Chesa Boudin is not the first San Francisco district attorney to push for criminal justice reform. Past DAs have done some pretty progressive things, too, like embracing cannabis before it was legal, rebuking the death penalty, and introducing algorithms to combat racial biases. And yet, each top prosecutor's record is complicated. In this next installment of The Progressive Prosecutor, we'll take a look at how we got here through the lens of three previous San Francisco DAs and the people who worked for them. KALW's Holly J. McDeed reports.
Courtney Burris works for Chesa Boudin now, but they met on different sides of the aisle years ago when she was working for District Attorney George Gascon.
We were in misdemeanors together. Like, he was a misdemeanor public defender. I was a misdemeanor DA. And we were always in the same courtroom together.
Burris is the daughter of John Burris, a prominent civil rights lawyer known for taking on police brutality cases, including the beating of Rodney King. And Boudin comes from a family of lawyers and criminal justice reform advocates.
But we just come from that stock of being raised in an environment of knowing the impact that you can have on your platform, you know, if you go out there and you use your voice and you use your talent and your advocacy.
Some experts say prosecutors are the people in the courtroom with the most power.
You are looking out for the vulnerable and the community as a whole, but at the same time, we are the decision makers. We are the ones who have the discretion to charge, the discretion to ask for a certain sentence, the discretion to give mercy where they might not otherwise be afforded.
Burris considers herself the beneficiary of a movement of nationwide progressive prosecutors.
For me, I was seeing the void in advocating for Black and brown victims. And also, as a Black person, understanding the inequities that people who are charged with crime face as well.
Boudin, too, has talked about how the justice system fails victims as well as people accused of crimes.
Most victims want the people who've harmed them to never do it again to anybody else. That's an important thing for most crime victims. And our system right now actually makes it more likely that people will commit crimes in the future.
In San Francisco, the idea that punishment can make things worse isn't exactly new, and neither are critics who say the city's prosecutors are too lenient. You can trace some of that debate to another controversial former defense attorney turned prosecutor, Terrence Hallinan.
What kind of society can deny to its citizens such relief from their pain and suffering?
At the Millennium Medical Marijuana March in Washington, D.C. in 2000, Hallinan stood at the podium wearing a suit and a baseball cap. He was a gray-haired man with a temper. He did not necessarily sound like your typical law enforcement official.
Let us reschedule marijuana and make this herb available to anyone who can benefit for its wonderful, miraculous medical properties. Thank you.
Terrence Hallinan and Chesa Boudin have a lot in common. The justice system impacted both of them personally, and they have both fought to change it. Both had family members who were lawyers and parents who were activists and eventually incarcerated. Hallinan's dad went to jail for contempt of court while representing union leader Harry Bridges during the Red Scare. Brendan is Hallinan's son, and he says Hallinan trained to box so he could learn how to fight back against critics.
And I think he was taught by his father that if you're going to stand up for what you believe is right, you know, you better be ready to take some heat because it's not always going to be popular.
But Boudin and Hallinan were also very different. Boudin enrolled in Yale after high school. When Hallinan was 18, he pled guilty to assaulting the owner of a ski lodge. And Brendan says that was a pivotal moment in his dad's life and the kind of DA he would become.
He always tells me he had a Marin County judge that was gonna, that gave him his last chance and said, okay, this is your last chance, Hallinan. You're gonna go to San Francisco, you're gonna get out of Marin County for a year, you're gonna enroll in college, this court's gonna maintain jurisdiction over you, you're gonna come back in a year. If you haven't graduated high school and aren't on your way to college, you're going to jail. If you have, then we'll go ahead and dismiss these charges against you because you've shown that you've been reformed. And he remembered that his whole life.
Hallinan became a defense lawyer, and then in 1996, the district attorney of San Francisco.
I gave people who had drug cases a break. I gave them a second chance, I gave them a third chance, I gave them a fourth chance.
He vowed to push back against the war on drugs and three-strike laws, but there was a lot of resistance. Fred Garner, Hallinan's press secretary while he was DA, says some political leaders were not happy he won.
Imagine the power as a cop. Imagine the power that you had when you could stop anyone on suspicion of marijuana. What a tool in your toolkit.
Garner remembers a T-shirt worn by an off-duty cop.
He had written on it, Hallinan is a commie sucker.
Hallinan's fraught relationship with cops was not just because of his stance on crime and cannabis. He also indicted the police command staff in what became known as Fajita Gate. This was in 2002, after off-duty cops violently beat two men after an argument about giving up their fajitas. Hallinan indicted the command officers over allegations of covering it up. The charges were ultimately dropped, but Hallinan's relationship with police was beyond repair. Progressive activists also accused him of not doing enough to hold police accountable. Hallinan's son Brendan remember seeing him in the living room with his files, deciding whether or not to charge a police officer who had shot and killed a 17-year-old girl, Sheila DeToy.
And he felt that, you know, he's this cop, he's just like a ticking time bomb, but I don't think I can charge him. I don't think the law supports me charging him. You know, he was very torn because he thought that the shooting was wrongful.
Activist Van Jones, now in anger with CNN, marched to Hallinan's house to demand justice. Hallinan's son remembers him coming out to address him.
He tried to explain to the best of his ability why he had to make the decision he had to make and why he couldn't have gone the other way and how he felt as a parent and as a person about what had happened. The compassion, and it was hard on him.
Then, in 2003, an upstart young prosecutor ran against him as more of a law and order candidate.
The race for San Francisco District Attorney is down to two candidates, the incumbent Terrence Hallinan and challenger Kamala Harris, and we'll go right to Kamala Harris.
Let's be clear, I'm not running for public defender.
That's from a debate from Harris and Hallinan on KQED's forum in 2003.
There are a lot of victims of crime out here in the city who deserve to have a district attorney's office that puts the politics in the trash can and instead deals with the reality, which is that there should be consequences when young men and women are being killed in the Bayview. There should be consequences for the fact that we have women who are being raped, we have children who are being molested, and those cases aren't being prosecuted.
During the campaign, Harris accused Hallinan of failing to keep communities safe from dangerous criminals. Hallinan had burned a lot of bridges as DA, and he was vulnerable, so it wasn't all that surprising when he lost. Harris was sworn in by Senator Dianne Feinstein in 2004.
During such time as I hold the office of District Attorney of the City and County of San Francisco.
During such time as I hold the office of District Attorney for the City and County of San Francisco.
Congratulations.
Nancy Tung joined the prosecutor's office while Harris was DA.
And I think that she brought a prosecutor's point of view to an office whose main job is to prosecute. But in doing so, too, she also brought a history with her about being a woman in a profession where, you know, you're also a minority.
If you look at her record as DA, you can find examples where Harris is both progressive and punitive. Her Back on Track program allowed first-time offenders to get high school diplomas and jobs instead of prison time.
And several of the initiatives in her first term really focused on making sure that recidivism was not something that we ignored, that we attacked the problem as prosecutors and gave second chances in a way to people who are just entering into the criminal justice system.
A truancy program that Harris had pushed for got a lot of attention when she ran for president. It allowed district attorneys to charge parents if their children missed school without a valid reason.
And I believe a child going without an education is tantamount to a crime. So I decided I was going to start prosecuting parents for truancy. Well, this was a little controversial in San Francisco.
Public defender Carmen Aguirre says you can't separate Harris's approach from the time she operated in. Like Hallinan, Harris would likely be judged by the number of people her office convicted.
The district attorney's office is navigating the politics of the community of San Francisco with the politics of law enforcement and the politics of fear that are perpetrated.
But when Aguirre thinks about Harris's time as DA, she thinks about her own clients. Many of them were given lengthy sentences instead of treatment.
I was moved by hearing Kamala say that, you know, like she was very much a product of the time. It didn't erase my hurt and pain for clients that, you know, were sentenced to state prison, deported, lost their lives, lost their homes to convictions that didn't have to be treated that way because they didn't require that level of punishment.
In 2011, Harris became the state attorney general, and then Mayor Gavin Newsom appointed George Gascon to her seat. Unlike Harris, Gascon had never prosecuted a case, but he did impress Newsom as police chief.
After 30 years in law enforcement, I have seen people who are extremely dangerous, but many more who are misguided. We can no longer afford to lock up the addicted or the mentally ill in the name of safety.
The year he was appointed, the Supreme Court had ruled that California's prisons were so overcrowded they violated the country's ban on unusual punishment.
I will not measure my success by the number of faces behind bars.
Correction officials were ordered to reduce the prison population. In 2014, Gascon co-authored Prop 47, a California ballot initiative that reclassified simple drug possession and minor theft crimes from felonies to misdemeanors.
I feel like Gascon started to think about things more and try to think about how to be fairer. I don't know whether that's because he was a quote-unquote better district attorney or whether it was that the community was more open to initiating changes at that level at the time when he was district attorney.
This was around the time Courtney Burris was hired as a prosecutor by George Gascon. She remembers how polarizing Prop 47 was in her office.
Because you had old school DAs who come from the train of thought of, you know, to do the crime, to do the time.
Burris says a lot of people left the office. She stayed, but she had to shift too. This country has relied on using money bail to determine whether defendants could get out of jail since its founding. Gascon called that system inherently unfair and archaic. Burris says she had to take time to shift her own thinking about money bail.
It's like, okay, well, you could keep things the same and keep using bail, and yes, it will be easier to keep dangerous offenders off the street. But the inequitable effect of that, to me, outweighs it because there are other ways that we can be addressing that danger, potentially, while still thinking of fairness.
At this point, Chase Boudin was a public defender, and he was fighting to end cash bail. When Boudin won the district attorney's race, Burr says it followed the trajectory of where San Francisco's criminal justice system was headed.
George was the battering ram, and Chesa is like the bulldozer, just like taking it to the next level.
Beyond bail reform, Boudin has proposed changes in the justice system that have not been tried before in the city, and now he's part of a bigger movement of so-called progressive prosecutors. Burr supports these efforts, but says all DAs need to be willing to pivot if their strategies are not working.
But I also think it's important that the administration and future administrations listen to the community response and also pays attention to the trends. If there is evidence to the contrary, that, you know, then it may be the case that the administration may have to shift.
Of course, one development Chase Boudin could not have anticipated was a global pandemic. That would affect all the trends and the data in the criminal justice system and the entire calculus around what it means to be safe. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
That piece was co-reported by Alice Wolfley with help from Christopher Agusa. You can find our series, The Progressive Prosecutor, at klw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba.
From the Garden State to the Golden Gate, out west, out west, out west.
Small music venues in the Bay are struggling to survive during the pandemic, but some are still providing space to artists and patrons for virtual performances. For 9 years, Tom Heyman has hosted the Sad Bastard Club at the Makeout Room in the Mission. The show features local musicians, and it's currently running on YouTube. Tom is a singer and songwriter, and he grew up in northern Jersey, where he developed a love for the guitar. He moved to San Francisco in the 90s and has been rocking it out in the Bay ever since. You may have heard Tom's sounds on shows like True Blood, Justified, and Damages. And his latest album is called Show Business, Baby. KALW's Janae Darden spoke with Tom Heyman about the motivation behind his music.
Tom, you are a bluesy guy. What made you pick up that guitar and just say, I got to do this?
I was born in the 60s. We really grew up in the 70s. You know, guitar music was everything back then, sort of. And in high school, I had this one teacher that showed me country blues stuff and some bluegrass stuff. And immediately it clicked. It seemed way more accessible than Led Zeppelin or something like that, which seemed too hard and out of reach. And this other stuff, I clicked with it. And that's probably what really got me going.
What brought you out here to the Bay?
Love.
Can't stand leaving you, baby.
My wife was living out here, and I was back in Philadelphia, and we had met in Philadelphia, and she had come out here for grad school, and I basically followed my heart out here.
That's sweet.
Yeah.
So your music falls in the category of pub rock. So forgive my ignorance, but how do you define pub rock?
Well, it was a movement. It's just in England, sort of pre-punk rock movement. Over here, they would call you a bar band. Over there, it was pub rock. And so it was Nick Lowe, Graham Parker, Dave Edmonds, Dr. Feelgood, all of them influenced by Chuck Berry. Just a little bit louder, a little bit faster, a little bit looser. My last record was really an homage to that era of music, sort of 77, 78, 79 era of a very specific four-piece rock and roll band. Two guitars, bass, drums, very few ballads.
Yeah, very few. I like it. I was listening to it, and I really like it. And I like the title, Show Business, Baby. I don't know. Is that how you would say it? Would you say Show Business, Baby?
That's how you would say it, yeah. Show Business, Baby.
You're very good with song titles and themes and your storytelling in your songs. Are these stories based on true experiences, real experiences?
Are they true? I'll never tell. They might be. Mostly, maybe.
Smile at me when I come around.
going down to 20, drink it for free. Telling you, boy, it's special to be. Show business, baby.
I want to go back to the title. So, what's that song, The Whiskey Wolf?
That just came from somebody saying, I don't know if they said it to me or they said it to somebody else, but they're like, you turn into a werewolf when you drink. And I don't drink anymore. And that just created this thing to me, like this transformation that can come over certain people when they drink too much.
From Monday morning to Friday night, he'll toe the mark, he does all right. A country mouse, a little lad. Yes, sir, no, sir, and thank you, man.
But then also, too, like, going back to their regular life is where it's kind of more quiet and boring. And
exactly.
Yeah. When I have drunk whiskey, hair does grow on my chest.
Yeah, there you go. Start howling at the moon.
I have been known to do that.
But he don't want to hurt no one. He just needs to have more fun. Nothing less.
First song, I think it's the first song on the album.
Baby, Let Me In, yeah.
Baby, Let Me In. You begging.
Baby, Let Me In.
Yeah, you know, the title came to me and then I just sort of extrapolated from there. Just the idea of someone who's sort of locked out of the house.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, come on. You know, and I just sort of took that scenario and ran with it.
And it was like, you were like, I live here too.
Yeah.
Like that part
just cold out on the lawn here.
You can do what you want to with whoever, baby, once I'm gone. Baby, let me.
I want to talk about the Sad Bastard Club.
So that is an event that I started doing at the Makeout Room 9 years ago. And, mm-hmm. you know, not only did I host this event there, but I also worked at the bar for a long time. It was a curated singer-songwriter thing with three artists, and I called it the Sad Bastard Club as a joke, sort of. It's just like, there's nothing sadder than a fool on a stool with an acoustic guitar, you know, sad, singing sad bastard songs. I just thought it was funny, and it stuck. People were on tour coming through San Francisco. You know, some bigger names have played it. I decided, you know, a few months ago that we're going to recreate it as a web series. So we started shooting actual episodes, and it's in the Makeout Room. It's been awesome, actually. A lot of people have been, that's my first gig in 6 months, you know.
How did it feel to get back in there?
It feels great. It feels like I never left, you know.
Are all the songs sad?
The songs do not have to be sad. They just have to be songs, you know, that you're proud of.
How has the pandemic influenced your artistry and your music?
Some people went into a frenzy of creating when things got locked down and had absolutely opposite effect on me. I haven't written a note of music since we locked down. I've been doing a lot of other things. I just don't feel particularly creative when that's sort of hanging over.
And I think that's okay, right?
It's got to be. I mean, I'm not going to beat myself up over it, you know. So I'm cool. I've had dry spells before. I'll get through it.
Don't knock it back till you try it. A couple things happen. Now it's too late. Break it, baby. You got to buy it.
That was musician Tom Heyman speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. Tom's latest album is Show Business Baby. You can watch performances from the Sad Bastard Club on YouTube. We've got a link at KALW.org.
I didn't think I could see that you were using me. Baby, you know I don't mind it. Cause I guess I used to do. Did what I had to do. I'll take my luck where I find it.
Today's Cross Currents team includes Azul Ekman, David Exume, and Marissa Ortega-Welch. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Production manager is Shireen Adil. Managing editor is David Boyer. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.